I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about autism. We're going to discuss what it is and what it isn't. We're going to talk about how the lives of autistic people are affected by it, and how the lives of the people who care about them are affected by it, too. Joining me today are Chad Gray, an Indianapolis police detective and the father of an autistic son, Vince LaMarca of the Lovas Institute, and Dana Renee of the Autism Society of Indiana. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits about autism. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a great group of guests today, starting with Chad Gray, who is an Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department detective and is the father of an autistic son, or a son with autism. Chad, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am honored you're doing a show on this topic.
We're glad to be doing it. Vince LaMarca, who is with the Lovas Institute. Vince, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me here. It's really exciting to be here.
And Dana Renee, who is with the Autism Society of Indiana. Dana, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
Well, what I want to start with an overview, because I think autism is one of those things people kind of vaguely know about but don't really understand what it is. So we're going to start a little bit with definition so that we drill down a little bit. And I'll start with Dana.
Okay.
Could you give us a definition of what autism is?
Sure. Actually, autism is something that's not super easy to define. We don't know what causes it, and as of right now, we don't know what cure there is, although there aren't very many people who are looking for a true cure, because autism is or can be considered to be a characteristic of somebody's being. And those characteristics, though, can manifest themselves across the lifespan, and we know that it is typically a neurological condition that is diagnosed based on evaluations of a lot of different criteria, from behavior to social interaction to eye contact, repetitive behavior, and there are just a lot of different aspects of autism, as well as types of autism, that people can come into contact anytime.
Well, my understanding, which is relatively limited, Vince LaMarca, is that we talk now more of it being on a spectrum to some degree. Could you explain what that is?
Yes, that's correct. When it comes to diagnosing autism, a lot of times there's three basic criteria that the psychologists will use to diagnose someone with autism, and that would include a child has low social skills for their age level compared to their peers, a lower form of communication than peers at the same age, and then on the opposite end, instead of having a low level, they'll have high levels of other behaviors that other kids won't have. And the classic examples would be things like flapping their hands over and over and over again, or jumping up and down over and over and over again. But it may be more subtle things like having a certain conversation that they want to have a lot, or a certain area of interest that kind of keeps them from branching out and talking about different things. And it's across the spectrum now, because you'll have some kids where the communication is low in terms of their nonverbal. They have absolutely no verbal skills. But with other kids, they may have really highly advanced skills when it comes to communication, but they just still have difficulty figuring out a way to interact with their peers the same way that typically developing peers often advance.
Chad, both you and Dana have children who are not that you are married. I should probably correct that. I realize the way I was setting that up might have caused some confusion. Chad, you have a son with autism. Dana, you also have a child with autism. Chad, could you talk a little bit about how it manifested itself with your son and when, you know, just tell us your story, I guess.
Sure. It's a common story. My son was a typically developing child until about 18 months. He lost his ability to speak. Once a child loses their ability to speak, you see an increase in behaviors like temper tantrums, problem behaviors. Without a lack of communication, you see all kinds of issues pop up. And basically the only way a child learns to communicate when they can't speak is by throwing temper tantrums. So we got that. Then we started getting some of the more common signs of autism with the repetitive behaviors called stimming, where a child will flap their hands in front of their face, lining up toys instead of playing with them normally, no social interaction at all with the parents or with anyone, no eye contact, no response to facial expressions from the parents. You almost feel as though your child's deaf. And some children with autism never speak from birth, but it's also very common for children like my son to develop typically until around 18 months.
Had he started to speak at that point?
He had. We were very, very lucky, and let me say this. My son is a twin. He has a twin sister. And we were very lucky in that they both were typically developing children, and at 18 months, a normal child is speaking several words, and by 24 months, a normal child is using two-word sentences, two-word phrases. At 18 months, when he lost his ability to speak and my daughter's language was flourishing, we knew something was wrong. Then come the sensory issues, which is also very common with children with autism. Sensory as far as tactile, as far as not wanting to touch grass, not wanting to touch sand with their hands, their feet, sensory issues with eating, certain textures cause them to vomit. There's a whole host. As you said earlier, autism spectrum disorder is a wide spectrum, but the things that are fairly common and typical that my son had were the loss of language, the lack of communication and social skills, and the repetitive behaviors.
How old is your son now?
My son is now 11. Okay. He was diagnosed. We were very lucky in having the twins is we could compare the two and we knew something was wrong. So what typically happens is a parent might suspect their child has issues, maybe some tendencies. They might do some research on the internet. When they go to their two-year checkup with their pediatrician, they'll bring up their concerns. And unfortunately, what often happens is the pediatrician will say, he's a boy, boys develop slower, let's give him 6 months, bring him back, see how he's doing then. As probably we'll cover later in the show, early intervention is the number one most important key to a recovery of autism. So that's the problem, is getting early intervention. So when you go in for your two-month checkup, if you're not satisfied with what your doctor tells you, ask to see a developmental pediatrician, ask to see a pediatric neurologist, a child psychologist, child psychiatrist, you know, whatever you need to do to make sure that you get a diagnosis or a clearance either way.
We are talking about autism here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Kate, who, in the interest of full disclosure, also is an old friend of mine, as you probably will pick up from the email. As you know, her sister and brother-in-law have a 10-year-old son with autism. He is nonverbal for conversation, but he can make requests or borrow video words to communicate. His parents are told he is very smart, but he cannot turn off his video playback or engage in purposeful play. He attended a life skills program at a school in Pike Township for 5 years. Last August, they put him in an ABA program. He lasted for 7 months until the beginning of March, and they used a three-step modeling program that didn't work for him. He learned to copy gestures, but not to listen. He didn't develop the ability to follow the three-step commands. They tried their best, but one size does not fit all. The parents sent him back to the school in March, where he is in a class with 9 students, 1 teacher, and 3 aides. He likes being with the other children and having the ability to socialize. He was accepted at Damar last year, but the director of special ed suggested he would not be a good fit because he was a tweener in the middle of the high and low functioning students. She expressed concern that he would mimic bad behavior. Here is my question. Her sister and brother-in-law are draining their retirement savings to try to find help. They are searching for the next step, which is where to send him to middle school in about a year. Where can they put their son, who apes behavior, cannot conduct a conversation, but likes to be with other children and needs socialization? Worthmore Academy looks promising, but the tuition is $11,000 a year. Her sister has contacted Flanner House to ask if they will accept him. They have applied for Medicaid and are on the waiting list. Are there any services available to people in their situation? And I think I read that and I realized it was a fairly lengthy email for a while because I think it gets to some of the complexity of dealing with all of this, in that there isn't a one-size-fits-all option. Vince LaMarca, why don't we start with her question
sure.
at the back and then deal with some of the other issues that the email raised?
Yeah, I mean, you mean starting with the question of what's
where
available?
What are some places to go for help if you are in that situation?
I think that's the exact scenario right now where there is very limited options at this point in time, unfortunately. It's one of those things when you look at where is it that the emphasis has been placed when it comes to research and helping children. On the one hand, you have programs for children when they're very young that are really well developed and work for some but not all kids. For those kids who the programs don't work for, and a lot of times we're talking about ABA therapy here in particular, for those kids who ABA therapy doesn't work for, there is that question of what's the next step? Where is it? What is it that you can do instead? And
probably
you know,
ought to explain again what ABA therapy is.
Sure, that's a good point.
Yeah.
ABA therapy is the most effective treatment found to date for children with autism, with a wide amount of research behind it, scientific research, especially compared to a lot of the other interventions out there.
And does ABA stand for something?
Yeah, it stands for Applied Behavior Analysis, which means it's based on the science of behavior, this idea that we can change our behaviors, that behaviors are mostly learned. And so ABA is a very data-driven program that works with positive reinforcement, this idea that if we want a child to do something, if we show them what to do and reinforce them, reward them for doing it, we can gradually break down a skill that a child's having difficulty with and then build it back up again until they're doing more complex things that they weren't able to do beforehand. So, for example, in this child's case, the mm-hmm. issue is always what is the skill that's trying to be taught to the child. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to teach a 10-year-old child to follow three-step directions, well, the problem may be that the three-step directions aren't what the child really needs. What's more important for a 10-year-old child might be doing things like, you know, my 10-year-old at home, he has to do chores around the house. Mm-hmm. He's learned to make his own snack and those sorts of things. And so a lot of times with ABA therapy, for example, what you would be looking at is, can you teach one step at a time so the child learns, well, first I need to figure out if I'm going to make a snack, where the snack items are located, how is it that you either request for those items or open the items and go through a procedure to actually make the snack.
Dana, but, Renee, this sounds, I mean, in listening to this, it sounds like if you are dealing with people with autism, there are a whole host of challenges here. There's obviously the challenge you want the child to feel loved, appreciated, valued, as we all do. But the parents here also sound like they have incredibly difficult parenting challenges, and then this whole financial worry thing. How common is that?
It's an everyday occurrence. We have people all over the state, and the staff from ASI are all parents of children on the spectrum, so we all know from that foundational, fundamental perspective of what it is like to have a child with autism. And I think that your friend hit on a lot of really important points. And the first and most important thing from my perspective is that autism is a very, very complex, difficult road to hoe, and every child needs something different, and what works for one child may not work for another child, or if something works for a child, it may not always work for them. And so I think it's important to understand that there are a lot of different opportunities, and finance is something that, you know, maybe we can talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, I have a feeling we're just getting started with this. We are talking about autism here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Chad Gray, Vince LaMarca, and Dana Renee. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about autism. My guests are Chad Gray, who is an Indianapolis police detective and the father of an autistic son, or a son with autism, I guess is the proper. I'm reading what is in front of me, unfortunately. I will correct it. Vince LaMarca, who is with the Lovaas Institute, and Dana Renee, who is with the Autism Society of Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. One of the questions that listener Kate posed that I don't think we answered that you might have an answer for in some capacity, Chad, is where there might be some financial resources for parents who are in that situation. Particularly, you've got a fundraiser coming up in the not-so-distant future.
Thank you very much for pointing that out. Sure. Let me first say you need to immediately apply for some of the waivers through the state of Indiana. Now, there are very long waiting lists, but the developmental disability waiver, autism services waiver, lengthy waits. Right now, the children's grant to the state of Indiana is available. If you qualify, which gets you about $10,000 to start therapy, my organization, Rodney Gives Back, which can be found at www.rodneygivesback.com.
Go ahead and give that again. People might not have had a pencil handy.
Sure. It's www.rodneygivesback.com. We have funds available to help children with autism. We fund early intensive ABA therapy, and we have money available for grants right now, and we have a fundraiser coming up in June at Plum Creek. Very well attended. We will sell out. We're almost sold out now. We get the support of Mayor Ballard, Mayor Brainerd, Mayor Cook, House Speaker Bosma, Fuzzy Zeller shows up, plays around. Very successful outing. We raise a lot of money, and all of that money goes for grants for children.
And if there are people who want the help, they try to contact you through the website.
If you go to the website, right at the bottom, it'll say email chad@rodneygivesback.com. If they will call me, we will send out a grant application. Mm-hmm. Then we will send out a board-certified behavior analyst, which is an expert in applied behavior analysis, just like Vince LaMarca with the Lovaas Institute. They will do an assessment of the child, come back, report to us. The board will vote. We will grant a scholarship to help the children.
We are talking about autism here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Polly, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Sorry. I have three boys. We found out last summer that I have a gene called ARX. It's an X-linked form of autism. So the questions about the cause, we've nailed down to my gene. And my oldest boy is 18 and a half. My middle child is 15, and my youngest is 3 and a half. I was wondering, because I've been having behavioral issues with my children, you know, there seems to be training for professionals in residential facilities, but there doesn't seem to be anything for those of us on the ground doing the hard work with our kids. I stay home and take care of them. So I was wondering, I wanted to ask the pros on the board, is there anything in Indianapolis that provides training for behavioral issues for parents that deal with self-inflicting and some other, you know, issues oppositional defiance, some of the other issues that you deal with with autism?
Very good question. Thank you very much for the call, Polly. Dana Renee, actually, we've talked an awful lot about how you intervene on behalf of the children and work with them, but the parents need support, too.
Right. I think there are a couple different opportunities. First of all, I think having a really good connection with the school and making sure that the behavioral supports that are being that are in place in the school are replicated at home and vice versa. I think, secondly, that by connecting with other families who have children with autism and specific behavioral issues, always working together to try to learn new things is important. And then the Indiana Resource Center for Autism in Bloomington has a lot of very good in-depth courses that parents can participate in.
At your fingertips a way to contact them?
If they go on to the Autism Resource Network of Indiana, and that's ARNIONLINE.org, they
go
can
ahead
search.
And do that again. Yeah, they may not have had a pencil already.
ARNIONLINE.org, and that's the Autism Resource Network of Indiana. And also on that resource, parents can find all different types of training around the state that is free or fee-based around a whole bunch of different topics and issues, whether it's behavior, behavioral support, all those types of things, as well as parent support groups, young adult support groups, those types of things. But I really think that it's important, and I'm really happy to hear that the caller is interested in learning more, and I think that that's something that is encouraging, and she should continue to encourage other families to do that as well.
I have one point out. If you go to the website www.acb.com, that stands for the Behavior Association. Never mind. I'm not going to say what it stands
okay.
for. So I'll forget. But
BACB.
BACB.
Though.
It's the board certification.
Yeah, the board certification for behavior analysts.
Okay.
The point is you can look in Indiana for individuals who are behavior analysts that may be able to help with specific behavioral issues. And what I would really encourage the caller is that you really want training, I think, that is going to actually be, if possible, with you, not just something that you go to learn information, but someone who will actually come out and show you what to do, watch you do it, and give you feedback. That's always the problem with this translation of, I have these behavioral issues with my child, is not just knowing what to do, but actually being able to do it.
We've gotten an email from a listener, and if you want to connect with us by email, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from a listener named Ann, who says, our 22-year-old son is autistic and mildly mentally handicapped. When he was small and became overwhelmed in public, a meltdown was manageable, and we learned to cope with the embarrassment triggered by stares and comments of bystanders. However, he is now 6 feet tall and weighs 180 pounds, a potential meltdown in public can now be seen by bystanders as threatening, and as such, there is a real danger that someone will call the police. He has these meltdowns often enough that as he has gotten older, we rarely take the chance of going out in public. I'm not asking for a solution for your guests. I don't believe there is one. However, if members of the public would just take a moment to observe situations before they would react, it would help so much. We actually were talking about a similar theme when we were in the break about the whole public education and awareness piece of this, of attempting to understand. Dana Renee, you're nodding your head, so
yeah,
I'm going to throw this to you first.
It just reminds me of when my son was younger, and he was diagnosed when he was 3 and completely nonverbal, and he definitely had his fair share of temper tantrums, and I got so fed up with all of the stares and people looking at me and actually commenting that I got a shirt for him that said, I have autism, what's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me for some reason just kind of ignore them because people just don't realize how hard it is for a parent to go to the grocery or to take a ride in the car or to go to somebody's home for dinner. I mean, the things that people take for granted as being easy, that's just not the case for somebody who has a child or children with autism.
We've gotten a tweet question I still struggle with that nomenclature, which is, what is the most important what is the most important thing people who do not know much about autism should know? Vince LaMarca.
Most important piece of information would probably be that it's not the parent's fault. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind, particularly with the incidences you see happening out in public and everything like that. It's just not the case that the parents are the ones that are responsible for all of these behaviors that you're seeing out in public. It's very difficult for a child with autism to adapt to his surroundings, and he or she is acting out right now because there's something that they need, something that they want, and parents are often struggling to figure out how it is to give to this child something that's outside of the norm.
Well, and I would think one of the challenges in dealing with this is because we don't know a cause, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's therefore difficult to define what the cure might be or even what treatment of some level would be.
And I think it's important to remember that if you ask a lot of parents, and I'm not speaking for all parents, and I'm not speaking for all people with autism, but there are a lot of people who are not looking for a cure. I would not want a cure for my son because it's not a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that autism is something that, while there's still stigma, there's still an opportunity for anybody with autism to have a very successful life. And I think that, you know, it's an okay thing to have autism, and that it could be a wonderful thing.
We are talking about autism here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Dee, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Dee. How are you?
Oh, sorry, I didn't quite hear my name, the operator didn't quite hear it.
Oh.
I am very
Good question.
Well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Your question, please.
My question is for the detective, and I am a recently retired person who worked in the human services field for over 40 years. Almost 22 of those years were with persons with disabilities, including persons with autism. And in that capacity, I had the opportunity to see firsthand the fact that police officers do not have time to get the training that they need to know how to handle a behavioral situation in a classroom when it escalates to the point that the officer intervenes and rolls up in a squad car in a uniform with a gun, and teachers do not necessarily get the training that they need to keep that from happening in the first place. But when it happens, children are, and I'm talking about 10-year-olds now, often escorted out of their classroom in handcuffs and placed in a squad car. And I am aware of one situation in which a young lady was physically lifted out of her seat in her classroom, handcuffed to a wheelchair, and rolled out to the car. I hope someone's going to tell me that we are going to do more to beef up training at Plainfield when school resource officers are initially trained. And if not, that this call today is going to result in someone paying attention to the interaction between schools and police officers. And
thanks very much for the call, Dee. I'm going to try to give Chad Gray a chance to take a bite at that. Chad, you probably are listening to that with two sets of ears here. One is a police officer. One also is a father.
Absolutely.
And speak with whichever side you want to first.
Well, let me say that we started having in-service training on dealing with adults and teens with autism, because that's the majority of calls we get. Sometimes we had an incident on a bus that was very in the news a couple years ago. The thing that people have to realize, especially with the police department, is that for every one incident you hear, there are 100 incidents where the officer handled it perfectly. So please don't think that every officer out there is overreacting to it. We do have in-service training. We had in-service training, I think it's about a year and a half ago now, with the Indianapolis Police Department. Can we use more? Yes. One thing that you have to take into consideration, that the officer has to worry more about the child hurting themselves, which is sometimes why handcuffs have gone on. The officer is worried about the child hurting themselves, sometimes banging their head against the floor, things like that, that officers aren't used to seeing. So let me say that there has been some situations that are totally unacceptable. But for every one of those, there's been 100 where they were handled correctly. Now, in-service for officers is happening and is continuing, and people like myself with children with autism are trying to facilitate more of that training. So it is very important. We do take it serious. The Indianapolis Police Department takes it serious. As far as Plainfield, I can't tell you exactly how often they do it. But a simple call out to them by myself or yourself would be helpful. So we do take it very serious.
Dana Renee.
The one thing that I'd like to interject is that the caller was referring to incidents that happen in school. And this year, this summer, actually not this summer, during this legislative session, we were able to work with some legislators to develop a bill around seclusion and restraint, and that's something that we've never had before. And last night in the House, it just passed the House. So now we are almost to the point that we will have a law around policy in every single school around the use of seclusion and restraint. And what that includes is training for administrators, teachers, officers at the school, et cetera, so that they don't have to call the police. It doesn't get to the point that the law enforcement needs to be called into the school, because this policy will ensure that there are people at the school who are trained to deal with these severe behaviors and these issues.
Well, give me a short, introduction to that. Assume I'm, an elementary school teacher somewhere here, and I have a child with autism in the class, and I'm beginning to see some of these behaviors. How should I respond to them? What is the appropriate way for a professional in that situation to deal with it?
Well, first of all, there should be, if there are behaviors, there should be a conference with the parents called a case conference committee, and members of the school team, including the teacher and the resource teacher and all of these other members of this committee, to discuss a behavior plan and understand what the issues really are. So what's important is, what is causing the behavior? You know, we're not interested in what the behavior is if we don't know what is causing the behavior. And it could be anything from the lighting in the classroom to the position of the seat to something else that we don't know. So getting together with the family and the teacher and the resource aides and understanding what could be done to help prevent the behaviors in the first place is where an educator or a teacher should start. If a behavior happens to come up that's unexpected, I think that there are people in the school who are trained to either do an appropriate hold if the student is in danger of harming themselves or somebody else. We're not saying that it is okay for children to hurt themselves or hurt other people, and that, you know, if they need to remove a child from a room for a period of time, that's an okay thing as long as it's being done in a supervised way.
We are talking about autism here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. My guests are Chad Gray, Vince LaMarca, and Dana Renee. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about autism here on No Limits today. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chad Gray, Vince LaMarca, and Dana Renee. I feel like we've emphasized the huge challenges here in terms of dealing with autism. We probably ought to indicate, and Chad, you had mentioned at one point, we ought to emphasize that there are ways to deal with this, that there are rays of light here, and that there is reason for hope.
There truly is, and thanks for pointing that out. A lot of times when a family gets a diagnosis, they see that as the end. They're crushed. They don't know where to turn. They don't know what to do. They start thinking horrible things about, you know, who's going to raise my child, who's going to take care of my child when I pass. And those are all normal grieving process, normal things to think. What I'd like to point out is when you get the autism diagnosis, that's the beginning, okay? That's the beginning of searching for a therapy. The therapy that you, in my opinion, need to be searching for is an early intervention ABA program. I can tell you that my son was diagnosed as very severe by a pediatric neurologist, pediatric psychologist, and psychiatrist at the age of 26 months. We were told, don't expect him to ever play sports. Don't expect him to go to college. He's going to be living with you for the rest of his life. That was 8 years ago. My son now, after 18 months of intensive early ABA intervention, through the LaVosse Institute, Vince LaMarca was the board-certified behavior analyst, now is a perfectly normal 11-year-old child. He won the city spelling bee this year for Christian schools. He placed first in speech meet, which is sometimes very difficult for children with autism to do, to give up and give a speech. He is the starting guard on his basketball team. Runs the give and go like nobody else. Proud of him. He has no problem making, keeping friends. We don't tell the teachers every year that my son was diagnosed with autism. At the end of the year, we say, how'd he do? Did you see any quirks, anything, you know, that we need to work on? They always say, no, he's a perfectly normal child, doing great, straight A student, no issues. Then we tell him he was diagnosed with autism at the age of 2. They find it very hard to believe, as do many. Now, there are a lot of people out there that find that hard to believe that have children with autism, and there are some people that feel guilty when they hear that story that their child isn't as far along. Let me say this. One of the great benefits we had was having twins to compare them to. So we knew at 2, hey, we've got to do something. So we were able to get started with an early intervention therapy. And even with early intervention therapy, with a very good BCBA and a talented therapist, 50% of the children are not going to make a recovery that we would like to call best outcome. Best outcome is an independently living child that really you can't tell that they ever had any diagnosis. 50% of those, the other 50% will make progress, but not a full best outcome progress. So the thing is, as soon as you get that diagnosis, don't wait. Get started on therapy. There is hope. And even if your child doesn't make a best outcome recovery, they're going to make progress, and they're going to make dramatic progress if you get started early enough while the brain's still forming. If you can get started before 28 months, that's optimum. And the problem, the average age of diagnosis here in Indianapolis is about 5.5 years old. We want to get that down to 2.5 years old, because we can really make some good progress then.
Vince LaMarca, in terms of, we also probably ought to give people some guidelines here. If they suspect that they have a child with autism, what are some of the signs, and whom should they call?
Sure. You know, again, diagnosis is actually occurring earlier and earlier nowadays, but it's usually around the ages of 2 to 3 years old. If you see some concerns at that young of an age that either your child isn't talking as much as you think that they should be, or they're not socializing like you see some of the other kids, either a brother or sister, or during play dates or something like that. You should really take a look at whether or not a diagnosis would be appropriate. I still know of a lot of even family members and friends who will mention the fact that, you know, their kid just doesn't seem to be doing things that they would have thought they would have done. In fact, there's a website, First Signs is the name of the website, and it actually shows typically developing children and then children with autism and some of the first signs that you often find when it comes to difficulties that young children will have. And you can go there and you can look at things like eye contact, not listening when they're called, not looking for signs of affection unless there's something very, very large happens that they need something for. And those kinds of things you should get a diagnosis or look to see if a diagnosis is necessary. The earlier you start, the more likely then that you can get an early intervention kind of treatment.
Can I just,
yes,
I'm sorry,
Dana,
can I just
yes,
add
please.
Something to that? Because I can just hear some people in my head right now. I completely agree that early...
Which would be a different condition, right?
That's right. I'm sorry. And I know that there are people who are listening who are saying, I know exactly what she's talking about. I completely agree that early diagnosis and early intervention is essential. It is not easy to get a diagnosis. There are not a lot of people in Indiana who can appropriately and accurately diagnose. There are long waiting lists for diagnoses in a lot of areas, and there are a lot of places in Indiana that don't have places to go that families can go for a diagnosis, let alone an affordable diagnosis. And so they're left to rely on the school system for that. And so my first point is that if you see signs that something might not be quite right, like all of the things that Vince mentioned, the eye contact, the lack of communication, the repetitive behaviors, et cetera, or if they're nonverbal or having trouble communicating, you can start with speech therapy or occupational therapy or behavioral therapy or consultation or ABA before you get a diagnosis. You do not need to have a diagnosis to start working on the gaps and the deficiencies that a child might have throughout their development. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that outside services and support, while it is very, very helpful to have those, financially, it's just not available for a lot of people. And so when we talk about the guilt that families feel for not being able to provide for their children, it is a very, very, very difficult course because there are some things like applied behavior analysis that are very helpful for some people. That same therapy might not be as good for other people, but absolutely unattainable for many. And so I think that it's important to know and that the listeners understand that there are a lot of different interventions and there are a lot of different ways that things that people can do to help children depending on where they are in their own personal situation.
We've got quite a few listener questions now, so I think if we can try to click through them pretty quickly. We got one from a listener named Jody who was a caller who did not want to go on the air, said, could the panel speak more on autism as a condition and not as a disease? Dana, I'll leave that with you real quickly.
The answer is yes.
Yes. Okay, we can be a little, we can speak a little more length than that.
I think it's a really great point because autism is not a disease. Autism is not something that you can take a medication for and get better. Autism is something that is lifelong. It is something that is treatable with intervention. It is something that is a characteristic of somebody's being. It is not a disease like cancer. I was giving a presentation to an Everybody Counts program at a school, and somebody said a disease is like leprosy. It's not like that at all.
Dr. Lovaas used to talk actually about the fact that, you know, the reason humanity does so well is because of the wide range of type of people that we have and the number of different people throughout the centuries that may have had some forms of autism and it simply not being be called that. The point of intervention isn't to change a child with autism to no longer have autism. It's to make it so that they can actually be happy in this world, healthy in this world, and survive on their own in the world that we live in.
And I'm going to violate my own rule here and ask a question that instead of a listener question here, but assume someone didn't get diagnosed until adulthood. Is it still worthwhile for that person to go through the diagnosis process? And are there
Just not very many services for adults right now.
There need to be?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, there are adults who have grown up, who have graduated from high school, gone through college, but are living this life that's very difficult for them. They may not be able to keep a job. They may not be able to get a job. But there aren't very many, more than a handful of ways for them to get social skills support or behavioral help or whatever. They've been able to kind of suck it up for this long, but there just isn't a whole lot for somebody who is high functioning at this point.
Kay, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Well, my daughter will be 23 this November, and I could write a book on how things were in the olden days of 1990 to 1995. But one golden, and we're originally from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We moved up here 5 years ago.
Your accent was a little bit of a clue.
Just a bit. But anyway, one golden opportunity that I feel parents need to know about is Vincennes University. And their mission is to provide an opportunity for higher learning to anybody who wants to attempt it. They do not require an SAT or ACT score. If you have graduated from high school, you are eligible to attend Vincennes. And they have a separate program. It's a little bit more money per semester, but it's called the STEP program. And your child is assigned a mentor with whom they must meet once a week. And each semester they have a one-hour life skills class. Now, it's taken my daughter 4 years to complete her two-year associate's program. But without that opportunity of getting in without an SAT score, I don't think college would have ever been possible. And she'll graduate next May with her associate's degree in office management. When she found out being a teacher was probably beyond her capabilities, she said, well, then I want to be a secretary at a school, and that's her big dream, and I think she's going to achieve it.
Thank you very much for that call, Kay.
You're welcome.
It's really, really good hearing that story. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
How does that, Dana, I noticed you were smiling while you were listening to that. How does hearing a story like that make you feel?
I love it. I love it because, you know, everybody should have the opportunity to go to college, and, you know, that should be something that parents think about and kids think about from the beginning, elementary school. And there's always a lot of discussion around diploma track versus certificate track. And, you know, without a diploma graduating from high school, you can't get into college and you can't get some jobs and you can't do a lot of things. And, you know, that's an opportunity that will open doors for her for the rest of her life. And the fact that she had the confidence in herself and the support of her family is awesome.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jean who says, my 12-year-old daughter has what many people call autism. We have tested her for heavy metal poisoning and have found that she has high levels of lead, mercury, aluminum, and other heavy metals. We are doing, I can't even pronounce this word,
chelation.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
To remove these metals. Lead and mercury poisoning have similar, almost exactly the same symptoms as autism. What do you think children, why do you think children with autism are not tested for heavy metal poisoning from the beginning? Why don't medical institutions eliminate heavy metal poisoning as a diagnosis before labeling our children with autism? Vince, I'll throw that one to you.
Sure. The easy answer is I don't know in terms of when it comes to if whether or not they do that. The other part of the answer that I would give is that I would just be cautious to say you want to follow the scientific research to see to what extent certain things may or may not be helpful. There's a website out there, the ASAT, the Association for the Science and Autism Treatment, that will list, there's over 100 different interventions for children, for people with autism out there, and it will give the different scientific research that supports each of the things out there. So there you go.
And I would like to add to
go
that.
Go ahead. I've got a question lined up for you too,
sure,
Chad.
Absolutely. You need to demand that. You need to demand for heavy metal, lead, mercury poisoning, and you also need to ask for a Fragile X syndrome test because that also presents many of the same symptoms. So that's one of the things where you're your own child's advocate. You need to go in and you need to ask for those things, and you can get those done.
Is that something that we haven't really talked about an awful lot, that parents who have children with autism really do need to gird up and be
champions. You are your children's champion, and you will not get all the services, all the testing, everything you need unless you do your research and you're adamant about it, and you go in and tell them this will be done, and you will do it, and you have to fight for them.
I don't think there's a harder diagnosis to have to deal with. Parents have to fight to get a diagnosis to begin with. They have to fight to look at different types of treatment. They have to fight to get the funding for the treatment. It's incredible.
But the good news is that if the parents fight and the parents are strong, then when the kids grow up, then they can be their own advocate.
We've got a real quickly, Chad, because we're running tight on time here. We've got a question from a listener named Dan who says, just want you to talk a little bit about the changes you've seen in children as a result of the early intervention therapies you support.
Well, you know, it's quite remarkable. As soon as a child learns to communicate, and one of the things, I'll try to make this as quick as I can, one of the things that some people will teach is sign language to a child that has no communication skills, picture exchange communication. Any kind of communication at all that you can get with a child to let them know there are other ways to communicate other than temper tantrums. As soon as that clicks with a child, you'll immediately see a great improvement in their behavior. So as soon as you get a communication method, then you start working on verbal communication.
Not to mention it makes it a little bit less lonely for both of you.
It truly, it opens up a whole new world. So that's the number one key, is getting some form of communication. And people are afraid if you do sign language, if you do PECs, they're always going to do. That's not the case. That teaches a child you can communicate, and it builds from there.
That's worthwhile.
Very, very important first step.
I think that is an appropriate last word for this conversation. I really want to thank you. This has been very pleasant talking with all of you. Chad, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Vince, thank you for spending this time with us. It was good talking with you.
Thank you as well.
And Dana, thank you very much for being with us. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. We will be back next week. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.